Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode consists of excerpts from events I've recently covered, specifically World Beyond War's No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference held in Washington, D.C. on July 6, 2024, and from the UNEC conference held in early April 2024 in St. Paul, Minnesota. The No to NATO, Yes to Peace conference was a counter-summit to NATO's 75th anniversary summit held the following week in Washington, D.C. UNAC is the United National Anti-War Coalition. We'll start with Djibo Sobukwe, a member of the Black Alliance for Peace and a former member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party.
Greetings, everyone. On behalf of the Black Alliance for Peace and its Africa team, I'd like to thank the organizers of this counter summit, this great counter summit, and also for inviting us to make a contribution. Today, US-led NATO has become a global axle in the wheel of the US military-industrial complex, which includes 800 military bases around the world in 85 countries. This does not include the 342 military bases in continental US. The US has at least 29 known military bases in Africa. France has 10 and the UK 9, all NATO countries. We can see that the US has far more than any other country and has working relationships with almost all African countries, all controlled by the US empire for the purpose of full spectrum dominance, driven by the ferocious appetites of corporate capital. Now, full spectrum dominance means US military control over land, sea, air, and space, which is the so-called fourth dimension of warfare, to protect US interest and investment, quote unquote. Protect, quote unquote, means guaranteeing operational freedom, and US interest and investment, quote unquote, means securing a variety of valuable mineral economic resources on the continent of Africa, which produce corporate profits. And this is done with the complicit neocolonial comprador partners for itself and its allies. The forever US war policy at the same time satisfies the economic appetite and material resources needed for the military-industrial complex, which is an integral part of the whole US corporate capitalist economic system. The late Dr. Walter Rodney accurately described the early foundation of colonial Africa's relationship with NATO in his book, which continues today, by the way, in his book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. He said, quote, "Needless to say, in the 1950s, when most Africans were still colonial subjects, they had absolutely no control over the utilization of their soil for militaristic ends. Virtually the whole of North Africa was turned into a sphere of operations for NATO with bases aimed at the Soviet Union. There could have been easily developed a nuclear war without African people having any knowledge of the matter. The colonial powers actually held military conferences in African cities like Dakar and Nairobi in the early 1950s, inviting whites of South Africa and Rhodesia and the government of the USA. Time and time again, this evidence points to this cynical use of Africa to buttress capitalism economically and militarily, and therefore, in effect, forcing Africa to contribute to its own exploitation." That's really important. The colonizing countries have managed to do this in several ways, most importantly by ushering in neocolonial governments that would do the bidding of the former colonizers after nominal independence. Several of Africa's colonizing countries have been part of NATO membership since its founding, such as France, the UK, Portugal, Belgium, and the USA. And therefore, they already had some military bases or installations, at least, in their colonies. The recolonization by way of neocolonialism was largely successful in spite of the fierce opposition and resistance by anti-colonial liberation movements and leaders. This class struggle also manifests itself in the Organization of African Unity, founded in 1963, where there were two contending groups of countries, one group that wanted to remain dependent, with a dependent relationship of the with the colonizing countries, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, those that opposed the continued colonial relationship. To enable the acceptance of the idea of a benevolent NATO, the colonial powers knew that they had to convince and recruit a neocolonial class of indigenous Africans who would do their bidding. This divide played itself out in the national liberation movements between those that were friendly to imperialist forces versus those who wanted a real break from colonialism. The great Kwame Nkrumah explains in his book, Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism, that the wide array of methods employed by neocolonialism ranging from economics, politics, religious, ideological, and cultural spheres. To do this, NATO works hand in hand with other mechanisms of imperialism, like the CIA, which is an instrumental, which was instrumental in the coup against the Kwame Nkrumah government and the murder of Patrice Lumumba, in which case the UN forces also were used as a tool to abort the anti-colonial government of Patrice Lumumba in 1960. Other countries that offered organized resistance to colonialism and neocolonialism included, for example, the Portuguese colonies, as was mentioned. As mentioned, Portugal was also one of the founding 12 NATO members. The great freedom fighter of Africa, Amilcar Cabral, called Portugal a rotten appendage of imperialism. He explained that Portugal, as the most underdeveloped country in Western Europe, would never be able to launch three colonial wars at the same time in Africa without the help of NATO. Furthermore, NATO, a creation of the US, uses Portugal and its colonies as part of the larger objective of domination of Africa and the world. Portugal concluded a vicious war against its colonies in Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, Angola, and Mozambique, much like the US did in Vietnam. In both cases, colonizing powers used the most modern weapons, including napalm, cluster bombing campaigns, killing thousands against guerrilla armies that refused to bow down. The Portuguese dictator Caetano was forced to give up economic interest in Angola to some of the NATO powers in exchange for NATO armaments and supplies. Yet, in spite of that, Portugal still lost the war against the heroic anti-colonial forces. The US NATO and US Africa Command, which is an appendage of the US NATO military command structure, all played a devastating role in the destruction of Libya in 2011. It is important to highlight this because it offers some important lessons. First, US imperialism and its NATO lackeys do not tolerate any country that charts an independent path of development, one that refuses to cow down to US hegemonic interests. Secondly, it also demonstrates how NATO can work hand in hand with other US Western dominated world structures, like the United Nations. In 2011, the UN Resolution 1973 gave political authorization for quote unquote no-fly zone and a blockade of Libya to implement its purported quote unquote responsibility to protect some citizens, which ultimately resulted in the destruction of Africa's most prosperous country. U.S.-led NATO forces launched a bombing campaign that lasted 7 months and killed tens of millions of people, civilians, and tens of billions of dollars in property and infrastructure damage. This shows how, although U.S.-led NATO sometimes uses the United Nations for political cover, it has no problem illegally overstepping its mandate, its UN mandate, to commit crimes against humanity and achieve its regime change goals. The illegal US-NATO war on Libya will be remembered as one of history's greatest crimes. Indirect and direct cooperation between NATO, the UN, the African Union, and the Arab League shows the expansive and deeply woven web of US and NATO reach. We would be remiss if we didn't include the example of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC has the highest death rate of all, with some 6 million people killed, when Uganda and Rwanda, which are US proxies, invaded that country in 1996, all to ensure the uninterrupted plunder of Africa's strategic raw materials, such as cobalt, tantalum, chromium, coltan, uranium, etc. These minerals are strategically important, not only for cell phones, but also for the technologies that drive the military-industrial complex. Those mentioned here are but a small sampling of NATO AFRICOM's bloody works in Africa. The US AFRICOM continues to operate under the guise of quote unquote training and humanitarian peacekeeping assistance. However, jihadist terrorist violence on the African continent has increased dramatically since the founding of AFRICOM and NATO's destruction of Libya, resulting in civilian casualties and instability. The West has used this violence as a pretext and justification for the continued use of AFRICOM. As the Black Alliance for Peace's AFRICOM Watch Bulletin reported, since the founding of AFRICOM, there's also been an increase in AFRICOM-trained soldiers, in coups by AFRICOM-trained soldiers. Consistent with what Nkrumah and Rodney and others warned of in the 60s, and the 70s, NATO continues today in the form of US AFRICOM, facilitating wars, instability, and the corporate pillage of Africa. AFRICOM's hypocrisy also explains why there's been resistance by African countries to host the AFRICOM headquarters in Africa, forcing it to stay in Germany. Their experiences with NATO and AFRICOM ensure skepticism of its self-proclaimed noble motives. The US-NATO death toll inflicted on the African continent makes any claim of concern for human rights hypocritical. The Black Alliance for Peace calls for the dismantling of NATO, AFRICOM, and all its imperialist structures. AFRICOM. Africa and the rest of the world cannot be free until all peoples have a right of sovereignty and the right to live free of domination. Thank you.
That was Djibo Sobukwe, a member of the Black Alliance for Peace and a former member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Next is Rainer Braun, who since 1982 has been active in the German and international peace movement, for example, as executive director of Scientists for Peace and Sustainability.
Dear friends, NATO is a North Atlantic treaty organization. And like Seven was showing, this is not any longer true. NATO is a global NATO. But Europe is playing still an important role in NATO, not only by the numbers of the member organization. And when I'm speaking now about Europe, I have to clarify that in reality, I'm speaking about the European Union and the militarization of the European Union. This means I'm speaking about 27 European countries. But happily, we have more countries in Europe. We have neutral countries like Austria, Switzerland, and Ireland. But we have also Belarus and Russia. Russia is a European country by culture, by history, and by reality, even when NATO partly denied this reality. So when I'm speaking now about the militarization of the European Union, I'm speaking about the development of European Union, which is against the background laws of the European Union, putting down in the Lisboa Treaty. The Lisboa Treaty excludes that the European Union has responsibility for military politics and military policy. But this is without interest for the leading political class in Europe. They are developing these militarization mainly since 2014, enlarging it with 2022 with the war in Ukraine, but starting it much earlier. What are the key points of the militarization of the European Union? First, like always, these are the military budgets. The military budget of the European Union countries, now the majority of them is spending more than 2% of GDP for the military spending. To say it, for 21 countries of the 27 countries are spending more than 2%. And Germany, to say only one example, of the biggest and strongest, economically strongest part of the European Union, is spending in 2024 2.12% for military spending. This is what Germany proudly announced to NATO, $90.6 billion this year, and it will increase the next years. And Europe, European Union, is enlarging these budgets during all the years and will do this in the future. So we are in a rising militarization of the European Union. This military spending includes that the European Union now has own military financial resources. They are partly a part of the budget of the European Union, but they have also special outstanding budgets for military spending. They are so-called the Peace Facility Fund, the Military Defense Fund, which include drones, research, and industrial projects, and start 2021. These are the two parts for spending, for military spending in the European Union. What they are spending it, they have the so-called PESCO, Permanent Structural Cooperation. These are common arms projects. They have now in the European Union 34 of these projects. All the main point of this project is that some countries of Europe are working together to develop these military projects. What are the projects? I will only mention two: tanks, and they are developing a new air fighter, the so-called air fighter after 2014, which is not only one plane, which is a plane combined with drones and a whole independent military system for war. And the same with this European tank. These are two of these projects. They have the European drone as a third project and many, many others. They are also developing, with these financial support of the countries, an own military industry. Have in mind that all the European countries in the past have small military research. You cannot compare it with the militarization of the United States. It was much smaller. But now they are developing an own military industrial complex on the European level, putting the forces of different countries together for common projects. The tank project is a project of Germany and France. The aircraft project is a project of Germany, France, Spain, and maybe in the future other European countries. So they are really, we will really get in the future a military-industrial European complex. And we have the same on the research level. In the past, you could not compare the European military research with the US military research. We never had universities which are living for military research and will immediately could stopped and closed when there would be no money for military research. In Europe, maybe a little bit with the exclusion in the former times of Great Britain, the military research was only limited at the universities. But these changed. We have more military research, and we have this combined military research on the European level. But this is the developing part of the militarization of Union. The reality is that the European Union forces are a part of military interventions. We have European Union troops in Bosnia and Herzegovina, we have them in Kosovo, we have them partly as part of the NATO troops in Afghanistan and in other countries. So European Union countries are an active part of interventional forces. And that is a part of the policy of the European Union also for the future. And they are a part of the confrontation to Russia. I'm speaking about Ukraine a little bit later. And this means we have European Union and above all German forces in Lithuania. We have 5,000 German soldiers now going to Lithuania and being a part in the military forces in Lithuania. This is against the NATO-Russian agreement, but no one cares about it. And it shows that we are now a part, the European Union is an active part of this confrontation. This also includes that we will have European Union troop, European Union money in Romania, developing now the biggest European base of the United States and NATO in Europe. It will be bigger than Rammstein. I think all of you know Rammstein, but the new military base in Constanța in Romania will be bigger than Rammstein. And you know where Romania is lying. It is lying next to the border to Russia. So this is also a part of the European Union militarization. And this developing of the bases is funding by European Union money. Partly, not only, but partly. That is the European Union development. European Union is an active part of weapons export. In the past, we had quite strong limitation in exporting weapons. For Germany, it was never allowed to export weapons to region of crisis and war. But this time is over. The European Union is exporting their weapons. And like Seven was saying, you know, the most lovely country for the experts are the dictatorships of the world. They are exporting to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar, and all these authoritarian dictatorships around the world. And we have specific funds now for Ukraine. The European Union is after the United States, or even more than the United States, the biggest funder for military and civilian support for the Ukraine. And you know, the main point of this money, it doesn't go to the people of the country. On one side, it goes to the corruption, and on the other side, it goes for military purposes. And no one in the European Union expect two presidents or prime ministers are speaking about ceasefire negotiation. I'm not in favor of the Hungarian president. I'm a little bit more in favor of the Slovakai president. But both are saying negotiation and ceasefire is needed. And I'm actively supporting that Orban was going to Moscow and was speaking with Putin. And the hate of the European Union leaders against this trip, you could see yesterday in the television. But it's a right step when you are not speaking with the other side. You cannot make agreements. And what the European Union is doing is militarization without diplomacy. And that is definitely the wrong way to do. What are now strategically, and I think this is more important than the different points, how the militarization is working. Strategically, the hegemon in NATO has only is only one country. These are the United States of America. No decision in NATO is possible when the US is not agreeing about it. But Europe is something like a junior partner. Trying to be independent in the past, or more independent in the past, but this is over. With the Ukrainian war, European Union is the junior partner under the hegemony of the United States. That is the role Europe is playing in the global NATO. They totally are a part of the political strategy of the United States. This means confrontation on two sides, against Russia in Europe and against China in the world. But Europe has a specific role, and maybe this role will enlarge under a possible new President Trump. This role is mentioned burden sharing. And the burden sharing means the European Union should take more responsibility for wars in Europe, above all for the war in Ukraine. This brings me to the final point. We are in opposition as peace movement to the European Union's militarization from the beginning, from the first moment. We are coordinating our activities with all European peace movements. We have common actions. We were common active in Europe against the NATO summit in Europe and against the European Union militarization. But what we need now is more engagement for ceasefire and negotiations in Ukraine as a key point for stopping the militarization, for coming to a turning point for cooperation, negotiations, and diplomacy. Our work is to stop this militarization and for engaging more people for peace. This is a challenge of the peace movement in Europe. We are doing our best, and we hope that we will be successful. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. You just heard Rainer Braun, who since 1982 has been active in the German and international peace movement. Next, we'll hear a song by Ben Groskop entitled We Say NATO's Got to Go. Ben Groskop writes inspiring songs relating to the movement for peace and justice and is the executive director of the People's Music Network for Songs of Freedom and Struggle.
Song I want to sing for you comes from a melody from the African-American spiritual tradition, Joshaphat, the Battle of Jericho. But this song, friends, it says, we say NATO's got to go, and I'm going to ask you to sing along with me, all right? Here we go. From Kosovo to Afghanistan, to Libya and Ukraine, the bureaucrats of NATO bring endless war and pain. They say they want a victory, so they're sending in more arms. But nuclear Armageddon doesn't seem to raise alarm. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. Raytheon and Lockheed make the weapons used to kill. NATO members buy them and the people pay the bill. We can't afford good housing. We can't afford health care. We can't afford clean water, 'cause NATO left us bare. Here we go. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got, so the people can live in peace. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. Washington made NATO to enforce its global rule. Now it's bombing pipelines where allies once got fuel. NATO domination brings hunger, war, and fear. But there's cracks in the foundation, and NATO's end is near. Remember what happened at Jericho? The trumpets began to sound. Joshua commanded the people to shout, and the walls came tumbling down. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. We say NATO's got to go, got to go, got to go. We say NATO's got to go so the people can live in peace. Thank you.
You just heard movement songwriter Ben Groskop performing We Say NATO's Got to Go. Next is KJ Noe, a journalist, political analyst, writer, and teacher specializing in the geopolitics of the Asia-Pacific region. He writes for Counterpunch and Dissident Voice.
Did anybody watch the presidential debates? I say presidential and debate. There was a little section where they had a little golf policy dialogue. Do you remember that? Okay. Now, the question is, why are they discussing golf handicaps and golf scores rather than public policy or war or peace or, I don't know, things like that, right? But there's a logic to this, because if you look at a map of golf courses, the density of golf courses by the million, and then you look at a map of NATO countries, members, partner countries, these maps coincide by about 90%. I'm not kidding, look it up. And you can also look up the map of countries that recognize Palestine, and that map also coincides. And if you look at a map of countries that supported the UN anti-Nazism resolution, you'll also see that there is a correspondence. So there's a pattern here. And the pattern is, coming back to the idea of golf, you know, a golf course can feed 3,000 people if it were turned into farmland, or it can entertain a handful. But why feed hungry people when you can amuse the well-fed, right? That's their logic. And if you don't believe me, NATO has its own golf club. You can actually do a web search. You'll see that there is a club where NATO members can play golf. And the distribution of US bases corresponds also to the distribution of golf courses. But let me tell you something that is really wow, really scary. The ruling elite, they never deprive themselves of anything. They never give up anything. So when they give up something, you know they are serious about it. When they give up their golf courses and turn them into missile bases, you know they are serious about war. And I'm serious, dead serious. Those of you who know anything about the FAD system in South Korea, you know that one of the most beautiful golf courses in the world was turned into a THAAD missile base. Currently, on the first island chain along the Okinawan Islands, Yonaguni and other small islands adjacent to Taiwan, there are golf courses that are being turned yet again into missile bases. So we know that the ruling elite are dead serious about war. And we've known this. I mean, you can see there's a deliberate pattern when it comes to war. The first thing that they do is they wage information warfare. That is, they manufacture consent for war through demonization and hate mongering. We're far into that. But the information war is the pre-kinetic dimension of war. And then they start around by shaping or setting the theater. And we're talking about they create coalitions, they pre-position troops and ammunition, they start rehearsing very intensive exercises. NATO has just done a 120-day exercise. I've been in the military. Military exercises usually only last 5-10 days. This is a 120-day exercise in Europe, but also for example, in South Korea. South Korea had 200 days nonstop of military exercises, back to back, including 20 exercises that involved strategic nuclear bombing rehearsals. So once again, I'm telling you, this is very, very serious. In South Korea, they're actually rehearsing the capture and transfer of POWs. That's how granular these exercises are. So the US is escalating to war with China. NATO is an integral part of this escalation because it is they're the goons of Western imperialism. They're the armed wing of Western imperialism. And my comrade Ben Norton has compared, or he's pointed out that the NATO leadership, some of the NATO leadership have been Nazis. You know, that the Nazi leadership became the NATO leadership. And so here again, the Nazis are at it again. Now, the US has been preparing for war since 2008. It created a doctrine of war in 2009. It's called air-sea battle. Does anybody know what the precursor to air-sea battle is? It's called air-land battle. They're not very original. Air-land battle was the NATO doctrine of war against the Soviet Union. Does anybody know where air-land battle came from? It came from the Yom Kippur War. It is Israeli war doctrine. It is deep battle extended in space and time, where nowhere is safe, there is no front or rear, there is no safety for civilians. It involves deep penetrating attacks on infrastructure. And we commonly know air-land battle as shock and awe. The US has been preparing shock and awe for China for 15 years now, and they've actually calendared dates. General Minahan says 2025, or his gut says 2025, and Admiral Davidson says 2027, somewhere in that range. So we have dates, we have doctrine, we are decoupling economies. There's currently a proxy NATO war with Ukraine, and originally the idea was war with Russia. China was supposed to be the main dish. War with Russia was supposed to be an appetizer or a dessert. There was a kind of a back and forth among the ruling elite, but the Nuland faction won out, and they wanted to barrel through Ukraine, through Russia, because Russia is just a gas station masquerading as a country, right? That didn't turn out so well. But anyway, NATO, as the arm of US imperialism, is building all kinds of alliances, in particular what they call the ITPP, or the Indo-Pacific Four. This is Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Korea. They're all attending the NATO conference. Yoon Suk-yeol is going to Washington right now as we speak. And here's the thing. We know that the Western Empire began with genocide. It has been unending genocide. It lives on genocide. It thrives on it, and it is now ending with genocide, a horrific genocide in Palestine. And this is why we have to stop it. It's time to stop NATO. It's time to stop the genocides. Now, the empire is collapsing. It's like a drunk at a bar. When the bar is closing, it doesn't want to go home, right? It wants one more fight, right? Its credit cards have been canceled. It struck out with everybody, but it's not going to go home. It's going to have one big fight. And the drunk, the Western imperial elite, they're drunk with power. They're drunk with 500 years of power. But it is now time for NATO to close shop and go home. We're sick of the genocides. We're sick of the violence. So that will be our work. This will be our work over the next few days, over the next months, over the next years, is to shut down this genocidal machine. It's time. Thank you.
That was KJ Noe, a journalist, political analyst, writer, and teacher specializing in the geopolitics of the Asia-Pacific region. We'll close with an excerpt from the UNEC conference held in early April 2024 in St. Paul, Minnesota. UNAC is the United National Anti-War Coalition. The excerpt features Minar Adley with an introduction by Sarah Martin.
Okay, my name is Sarah Martin, and I'm a member of WAM, Women Against Military Madness. Woo, that's right. And we've been around since 1982. That's a long time. And we came out of the anti-nuclear movement in the early 80s and the wars on Central America, and we've opposed every U.S. war, intervention, whatever since, so we've been busy. One of the things we do is every Friday, we've done this for over 25 years, we go to a busy intersection near McAllister College, and we banner for Palestine, for a free Palestine. Now, liberation of Palestine, right? Next phase. After October 7th, of course, our numbers have grown to, we were about 9 or 10, but after October 7th, we've grown to anywhere between 60 and 200 people. Yesterday, how many of you in this room were able to get there yesterday? Woo! All right. So you know what it's all about. And you heard the honks of the cars. We used to mostly get fingers, but now we get honks, so. We are very proud to be a part of this amazing movement in the city, which you heard from at last night's panel. We are also proud to be a longtime member of UNAC. And today, I get to be the lucky one, and I'm very honored and excited to introduce our speaker, Minar Adley, an award-winning journalist and the founder and director of Mint Press News, an independent watchdog outlet that covers the permanent war state and those who profit off it. Not MSNBC, right? Minar was raised and born in this country, but in her early preteens and teen years, she and her family lived for 4.5 years in Palestine. During that time, the Second Intifada began. She says that's actually where Mint Press actually began or was born. In her teenage years, she experienced and saw the brutality of the Israeli occupation and apartheid regime. Bombs being dropped on civilian homes, having the water cut off, curfews, classmates being blocked from going to school. Sounds way too familiar still. When she moved back to the U.S., she turned to the media to keep up on what was happening in Palestine and quickly realized that what was being reported was false, distorted, and turned the narrative on its head. As a result, we have this important global news source which she has fearlessly and courageously developed. She has assembled an amazing group of journalists who provide up-to-date reports and analysis. She never backs away from confronting false narratives and persevered through the attacks on her journalism about Syria. Let's hear it for that. Yes. She also produces and is co-host of the Mintcast podcast. It's called Mintcast Podcast, and of the video series Behind the Headlines. She was the first American woman to wear a hijab to anchor or report the news in American media in 2009. Manar is the recipient of the Women's Institute for Freedom of the Press Award and the Serena Shim Award for Independent Journalists. We are fortunate to have her here in the Twin Cities, not only because of this wonderful global resource, but also to cover our movement. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Manar. Give it up for Manar.
Hello, hello, everybody. Assalamu alaikum. It is truly an honor to be here with you all, with a very vibrant group of people who have united against the cause of war. And I really appreciate Sarah's very beautiful introduction of me. I'm very humbled by that. Thank you. But it has truly been a very difficult past 6 months. Over the past 6 months, we've witnessed many, many dark moments in the history of mankind. Over the last 6 months, we've witnessed the worst of what human beings are capable of. War crimes and atrocities being committed using our taxpayer money. We've witnessed the most degrading, most humiliating, and most inhumane treatment of a defenseless population. Every single day since October 7th, and before that even, we collectively witnessed in absolute horror an apartheid state commit the most horrific crimes right on the screens of our smartphones, with complete and total immunity. We witnessed our leaders give the diplomatic cover and the very weapons to Israel to commit this genocide. Our eyes became witness to dismembered children with their limbs blown off. Our hearts heard the cries of the helpless fathers carrying their decapitated babies while collecting the body parts of their wives and children in plastic bags. We heard the screams of the mothers carrying the dead bodies of their children, crying for them just to wake up. We were told that 41,000 people, including 15,000 children, murdered, were all collateral damage. But we know, based on the testimonies from Israeli soldiers and Israeli intelligence officials, that these deaths were not by accident. Israel has the most sophisticated AI technology, like the Lavender system and face scanning technology used by their eyes and ears in the sky, that knows every single person in Gaza and watches their every movement. The U.S. gives Israel over $10.4 million a day in military aid, money that is paid for from our taxpayer money. And with this kind of funding, Israel has developed some of the most sophisticated war technology that is battle-tested in Gaza. Israeli intelligence confirmed that Israel is using their AI Lavender system to intentionally target civilian homes, apartment buildings, schools, and hospitals to erase Palestinians. And this is an intentional policy that is designed to create as much carnage, as much despair, and as much destruction as possible. But this has a name, and it's called terrorism. Terrorism is defined as the unlawful targeting of civilians for a political purpose. And Israel has openly stated that their political purpose is to erase Palestinians, to put pressure on Palestinians to end their resistance. Israel is using terrorism to pressure Palestinian civilians to kill an idea, the idea of liberation, the idea that Palestinians exist, the idea that Palestinians have a right to return to their homes that Israel stole from them. an idea that Palestinians deserve to live and exist and resist their occupiers. But what Israel is doing in Gaza is not only terrorism, but it's what the United States has done around the world for decades since World War II. And the media and our politicians continue to gaslight us. We see them donning their perfectly ironed suits, State Department officials and White House spokespeople look at us straight in the eyes with a smile, telling us that they see no evidence of Israel targeting civilians. Why would they? Why would they say that Israel is committing war crimes? Israel is a terror state backed by the biggest exporter of terror in the world since World War II, which is the United States. What Israel is doing in Gaza is just an outward expression of what the United States has done for decades against the global south, to Africa, to the East Asia, to the Middle East, in its carnage of arming and funding death squads, overthrowing democratically elected governments, backing and arming apartheid and genocide in its occupations, in its extractions of minerals and oil, and in its sanctions regimes, its wars and policies that have killed millions of people around the world and displaced millions more. So let's not forget Yemen. Let's not forget Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, Brazil, South Africa, Rwanda, Sudan, Mali, Somalia, Congo, Vietnam, Japan, the Marshall Islands, an endless list of countries too long to mention here. And we were reminded just this week with the 14th anniversary of WikiLeaks' release of the collateral damage video, showing U.S. military drone operators targeting and killing Iraqi civilians and Reuters journalists in Iraq. Isn't that what Israel has been doing every single day in Gaza? Let's not forget the U.S. killed 1 million people in Iraq and 1 million people in Afghanistan. The United States used white phosphorus and banned chemical weapons in Fallujah, where children are still born today with birth defects. Isn't that exactly what Israel is doing today in Gaza? What the war in Gaza has done is really just expose the moral depravity of the so-called rules-based international order. They've weaponized democracy and human rights to promote endless wars and profits for weapons manufacturers. But in the darkest moments of this horrific tragedy, a light has certainly shined through. It is the collective humanity of us all, one by one, who have organized, who have spoken out, who have boycotted, who have educated, who have disrupted, who have shut it down. The tides are turning. In these dark moments, the ripple effects of change created a global tide. This is a global awakening, and the Intifada has now been globalized. The world has spoken for Palestine, but it has also broken through the fog of war. The fog of war of the endless wars that have been sold to us as humanitarian wars. It has risen above the media manipulation and the propaganda machine that for far too long manufactured consent for apartheid under the guise of shared values, democracy, and human rights. But we now know that those shared values mean colonialism, occupation, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and grave human rights abuses. Millions of people across the globe are taking over the streets of Palestine. We are shutting down the weapons factories across the UK, like Palestine Action. We are occupying the offices of our elected officials. We are protesting in the lobbies of the propaganda machine, the New York Times. Yemen, the poorest country in the Middle East, is being bombed anew nearly every single day by the U.S. military because they enforced a Red Sea maritime blockade of Israeli ships, while Palestine's Arab neighbors currently and actively assist Israel to circumvent that blockade and even assist Israel in the genocide. Yemen has endured over a decade of a humanitarian crisis. 23 million people have been starving because of a U.S.-backed Saudi blockade. Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia continue to pay lip service to their citizens while assisting Israel in its genocide and doing normalization treaties behind the scenes. But the people of the world have broken through the fog of war. They're saying no to normalization and not believing the atrocity propaganda blitz. Just like the incubator babies, weapons of mass destruction, and the Gaddafi mass Viagra hoax that brought us the wars in Iraq and NATO invasion of Libya, we as a collective have broken through the fog of war. And most importantly, here in America, the Democratic Party has finally shown its true face, taking off its mask so Americans see that it has exposed itself as the bloodthirsty, war-hungry party that it is. We see and hear Genocide Joe quite loudly and clearly. We cannot rely on our leaders to save us and stop this war. The power right now is in our hands, and we will continue to disrupt the war machine until the entire system of endless wars turns into endless peace. Thank you.
That was Manar Adli with an introduction by Sarah Martin. They spoke at the UNAC conference held in early April 2024 in St. Paul, Minnesota. UNAC is the United National Anti-War Coalition. You've been listening to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.